Blog Talk Radio.
Hey, good evening. George Dixon joining us, and we also have a gentleman named Ross Hamilton, who is an author and researcher.
Expert on the inner earth, I believe.
Yeah.
And giants.
And the serpent mounds and giants. And we're going to be talking to him shortly, but I believe this is George here.
Yeah, that's what, just click that right there.
Hang on a second. George is joining us. Good evening, George.
Good evening, Lila and Leo.
Hi, George. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm enjoying the summer. How about you folks?
Oh, very much. We did have a rainy day, though, here today, partially. Did you have bad weather?
No, we had pretty good weather. It rained here maybe for about 5 minutes, but that was it. But, no, we
all right. Then we got it for a good hour. But, hey, listen, is Ross Hamilton joining us tonight?
Yes, he is. I just got done speaking with him, and he should be joining us shortly. You'll probably see him come in through the hookup you got there. He'll be calling in.
Why don't you tell the folks at home who are listening a little bit about him?
Well, I have to go back to a research paper that I believe he put together called A Tradition of Giants. And at that time, I was interested in giants, from all different aspects, from the east, from the west. And this was given to me by a good friend of mine, Brendan Brigadier. And I read it, and I think it had a lot to say about information we knew nothing about because it was never told to us. And I want to make it...
You read this too, Jordan. We did that show with Brendan, remember?
Yes, okay.
Year.
Yeah.
And we read
that.
That was actually a book that he published there too.
Yes.
But what I was hoping to talk about tonight was I was hoping to get into the inner earth aspects of things. Is Ross going to be able to talk to us on that, or...?
Well, my understanding is that he's done some research on that, and, I'd be interested in finding out, the Hall of Records that Casey talks about and other people talked about, possibly, under the Sphinx in Egypt, but he may have some knowledge of the tunnels that go into the inner earth, and, the mound, the Serpent Mound is just one aspect of maybe some of that tunnel formation, but he'll be with us and he can answer, I think, the questions we have.
Oh, good. Now, how did you meet him, George?
Well, I haven't met him other than just his work I followed. Like I said, it was through a friend of mine, Brendan Brigadier, that I met him, or I read his materials and I was introduced to his materials. And,
oh, excellent.
I wanted to... spent some time with his other book, The Serpent Mounds, but I haven't had time, in the last years or so. My studies are different, but, it's just one aspect that I would love to spend time with. But he's done it, and I believe him and his wife both have spent time, I think, in working with tourists and people coming to want more, to learn more about these mystery places around the earth, and of course, with the Serpent Mounds. But I know he's dedicated to, understand and preserve, the aspect of ancient societies that we could still look and understand.
Well, we can tell the folks at home just what a serpent mound is. A serpent mound was built by one of the cultures known as the Mound Builders. These people built mounds in a large area from the Great Lakes to the Gulf of Mexico and from the Mississippi River to the Appalachian Mountains. Mounds vary in age, some dating back as early as part of the 6th century, while others, especially those in the southeastern area, were built in historic times. Stone, copper, mica, obsidian, meteoric iron were widely used by the prehistoric mound builders. Obsidian, coming from the Rocky Mountains, mica from the South Appalachian Mountains, and copper from Wisconsin, indicate widespread trade. The people practice weaving and pottery making. And that's from that. Where did you get that from, Leo? From Wikipedia?
Well, this is a great serpent mound. This is actually from the website that you sent me, George. You still there, George?
Let's go back.
Hey, George.
George?
Oh, we lost George for some reason.
He's still on.
Hello, George. If he put himself on mute.
I don't know. That's odd. Is our phone working?
Yeah.
Hello, George, you with us?
Leo?
Yeah.
We're here.
Hi. Ross, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Yeah.
Can you hear me okay?
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you now. I couldn't for a while. Can I hear you? Can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you very well.
I'm sorry. We had some problems with the phone here, so what I did is I teleconferenced him through my telephone line. And, Ross, I want to welcome you to the show.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Can he call into the show?
No, he called in to, I call him on my connection.
Well, it'd be better if he called
directly. We can't hear him. We can't hear anything, yeah.
Oh,
I see. Have him call directly into the show. We'll give you the number. 646-915-9505.
9505.
616-915-9505. Could
you repeat that one more time, please?
9505.
You
hear that?
Ross, the number is 646. 915-9505.
915, okay.
Okay. Right, just call back on that number.
Because okay. We can't hear you.
Okay, Leo, Lila?
Yeah,
we got it.
Thanks.
Yeah, okay, I heard him click off there. So I'm back on with you in my normal line.
We couldn't hear him at all.
You can't do it that way. He has to call directly into the show.
Okay, well.
I know we've done it before, for some reason it's not working so good.
Yeah.
He's probably on a cell phone or something.
It's an old trait that I have. You know, in the Marine Corps, we learn to improvise. And like I said, it's a lot easier for me just getting on a conference call, and I could just drag him along with my phone call.
I understand what you're saying, but because of this system, it doesn't always work too well.
Yeah, we couldn't hear him at all.
Yeah.
It was very, very faint. So I don't know whether it's because there's a new switchboard and it works in a different manner. I have no idea. Leo had a very hard time getting this new switchboard. I don't even have it on my browser.
Are you, I'm hoping he got the right number.
Well, I believe he did. If not, I'm sure he would call me back. I'll give him a little bit of time yet, and we'll see what happens.
Okay.
But, you know, I thought last night's show was very interesting, Leo, and I wish...
Yeah, Peter Moon is a great guest.
Yeah, I was kind of listening to that as I was working. I thought you guys did a great job.
Yeah, well, I'm so enthralled by some of Peter's work because he has a way, he's like the gears that turn, and with him, the synchronicity of every. I got somebody else calling me back again, so hold on, please.
Okay.
I'll call you again.
I thought he always had the people just call directly in.
He did. Oh, there was one time he did that with somebody.
Yeah.
Oh, it was Alfie.
Oh, okay. It's better to have them.
But
for listeners at home, it's better to have
them. But when it's cell phone to cell phone to cell phone, that never works.
Yeah, it's not very clear. So hopefully, folks, we'll get him to call in and give us
A rundown on what's happening.
So,
but we got. Let me just read a little bit more about this while George is talking to him.
Hello, are you still there?
Yeah, we're still here. What's going on?
Okay, he's going to call back. He had a little problem with the phone number, but he'll be calling shortly, I'm sure.
I thought so. Yeah.
Yeah, I was anxious for Peter to talk about some of the inner libraries, you know, that they found in the Bootski Mountains, and I'd be interested in maybe Ross may have knowledge of, you know, of the libraries. Of course, there's supposed to be something like 80,000 or 80 sites around the world that hold these records, and these records are just duplicated. So you lock into one, you have the other. But what's interesting with Peter is the tunnel systems, and I was surprised to learn that the third book is relating to the tunnels that go to Egypt, or the Giza Plateau.
Is with us now, George?
Okay.
So,
good evening, Ross. Are you with us?
Oh, good evening. Can you hear me?
Barely.
Barely. You've got to talk directly into your phone.
Okay. I have a new headset. Is that better?
Yeah, that's much better.
That's a lot better. We could hardly hear you.
Okay. If you get any static, let me know. If it's too staticky, let me know.
Ross, I'm sorry, Ross, for the connection and so forth, but if you can hear us okay, we can hear you fine.
Yeah, I can hear you very well.
Yeah.
Now, Ross,
I'm just thinking, I can actually call the guest, you know, as well. Let's see.
What difference is that going to make?
Well, the connection might be better because, man, the connection is not very good.
We can try calling you, Ross.
Okay. Give me a call.
That's all right.
Yeah, we can hear you all right. A little better now.
What are you doing that's different right now? You don't sound so staticky.
Well, I'm holding the mouthpiece close to my lips, and if I get it too close, it gets staticky, and if I hold it too far away, you can't hear me.
Yeah, Ross, move it just a little bit away from your lips, just a little bit.
Okay, is that better?
That's okay, yes.
You can hear
that. It's like blowing into a microphone, that's what it sounds like over the air, but no, it sounds much better now.
All right, well, I'll try it this way, and hopefully it'll work.
Okay, well, Ross, you know, I'm trying to introduce you to the audience here, and you know, you have two books, The Mysteries of the Serpent Mounds, and the Tradition of the Giants. Did you have other publications?
Right, I have a third book coming out next spring through Random House, called Star Mounds, or we might decide to call it Starcraft of the Ohio Valley.
Ooh.
And it deals with an ancient city spread out over hundreds of miles in the old Ohio Valley that archaeologists have barely been able to recover, seems to date back as much as 5,000 years, and is like a Glastonbury. Are you familiar with the plan of Glastonbury, England?
Yes.
You know, Ross, we can't really hear you very well. And it's a lot of static. I'm going to try to call you. I'm going to call you. Are you on a cell phone or something?
No, I'm on my hardline phone, but I'm handicapped, and so I have to use this headset, and I don't think it's a very good headset.
Oh, okay.
So it probably wouldn't. You sounded very clear there. Whatever you did, just keep doing that.
You're much clearer, yeah.
So this is clear right now?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay, well, I'll try this then.
That's excellent.
You know, whatever you're doing, it's a lot better.
All right.
I have to apologize for not going through your bio and listing your credentials. I know you're a graduate of the University of Cincinnati.
Yeah, I'm a Cincinnati alum, UC alum, but that was back in the '60s. So
okay,
you get some idea of how old I am.
Hey, you were born in New York, though, right?
That's right. I was born on Long Island.
Oh, there you go. I'm a West Islip boy myself.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Ross, if I can ask you, what got you involved? Your first book was the Giant book, right? Traditions of Giants?
No, actually, the first book was The Mystery of the Serpent Mound. The Serpent Mound is an artwork that's world famous. It's located in Adams County, Ohio. About the middle of the state, but right by the Ohio River, so it's the bottom center of the state, I guess you would say, or bottom middle. And it's basically an earthen effigy to a serpent that receives thousands and thousands of visitors every year. So it's quite beautiful there. I volunteer there and work at the gift shop, and I sell my books there.
Hmm.
So I have a pretty good knowledge of it, but the research started about 25 years ago, actually 27 now. And it started out where I was taken there by the American Society of Dowsers, Great Serpent Mound chapter. And these are all men that were much older than me. They were in their 70s and 80s back then. This was back in the early 80s. And they showed me that the serpent wasn't all that it appeared to be. And in fact, beneath the surface, there were a number of strange anomalies that they were picking up with their dowsing rods. And they gave me a map, and I took that map, and I was able to extrapolate some of the hot spots that they had dowsed out. And lo and behold, I came up with the Flower of Life geometry, the same one that Drumbelow Melchizedek put together. But this was a couple of years before he published it, so it was very interesting. And the serpent fit perfectly upon this field of 37 points. Well, later we found out that this subterranean kind of spiritual magnetic field with these 37 points formed into a hexagon that had 24 points on the outside. Actually, it had six sides, but it was divided into four points where from the lines were drawn that met with these hot spots. And so you're looking at the Flower of Life geometry. But it's also mentioned in the Revelation to John. It's back in, you know, the Revelation, and it talks about how John was called up to the throne. And behold, he saw, you know, the Lord on the throne, and then he goes on to describe what apparently is an ancient code for the physical matrix of the proton. Now, I'll explain that very briefly, but essentially, this was the teaching tool for the old mystery colleges, this kind of geometric premise held so much information, but it also reflected the spiritual aspect of the person. So a lot of what the mystery of the Serpent Mound is about is the fact that the serpent interpenetrates the atom and gives it life. And so the serpent was the symbol for the Logos in the ancient days. And native people apparently took care of this, although it goes back to a time that far predates any historical tribes. So it's a great mystery. Now, what's really profound about the serpent is that what we've been able to find out over the last 25 years, along with a number of astronomical alignments that it has, is the fact that it could have served as a lightning totem. It could have been used to draw the lightning or the electrical forces out of the immediate vicinity, out of the clouds. And we think that the old shaman class may have utilized this kind of Manitou, which is what Native people call these things,
Manitou?
Or spirit animal, in order to process lightning and get the essential fertilizing and life-giving aspects out of it. So,
well, how would that work?
Well,
the effigy is about a quarter of a mile long.
Uh-huh.
It has a coiled tail at the end, and anybody that's online can just go to Google Images, type in Serpent Mound, and you get a number of pictures of Serpent Mound up, mm-hmm. even while you can listen to this broadcast.
Mm-hmm.
And the serpent was built on a promontory made entirely of limestone, dolomite in combination with magnesium. It is an important form of limestone because it has a great capacitor potential.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, I think George Dixon could tell you that capacitors are very important for some of the ancient arts and sciences. Like the Ark of the Covenant was more than likely a type of capacitor, but this limestone outcropping, which probably weighs, several thousand tons, it was carved by water on both sides of it. So the serpent appears to be laying out on a sort of isthmus, if you will. And the whole scene is set inside of an ancient meteor crater. And the crater is about 4 kilometers across, maybe 4.5, and it's kind of circular, and it's probably 300 million years old, a very ancient impact, but it's huge. It's one of the largest ones on the Earth.
About
and
3
it's
million?
Fractured, excuse me?
You said 3 million years old?
No, 300.
Oh, 300,
million
okay.
Years old. Yeah.
Oh, geez.
And it's fractured the rock down for as much as 2 to 3 miles. So they sent the U.S. Geological Survey team out there during the 80s and the 90s to see if they could, you know, prospect for any rare minerals.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And indeed, they did find a lot of the elements that only occur at the core of the Earth or from meteors coming in. But they chose not to mine it because the land was fairly unstable. There was quite a few fault lines. But the effect of this rupturing of the rock sends up a constant flow of positive piezoelectric energy
mm-hmm.
to the surface of the crater. And the energy tends to gravitate, or I should say, it tends to move out toward the margins of the crater and to the high points. And the Serpent Mound is located toward one of the margins on one of the high points. So it gets an abundance of this very positive electrical energy, and
mm-hmm.
you can feel it when you go out there on a day after it's mm-hmm. rained, when the sun is bright, perhaps. The hairs on your arm and on the back of your neck will just start to stand up as you walk around the serpent, and the path is probably about a half a mile long, and it's not level either. It kind of dips down in the middle and goes back up. So the serpent was made using a very special formula that seems to have designed it to hold and trap these energies from the earth. And I say that because the serpent's composed of several layers. It has a layer of loess, like gray clay, on the bottom of it. And then it switches over to stone. And then it turns into yellow clay. And then there's more soil is put on top of that, clay soil. And then there's a coating of topsoil. Now, anyone that's familiar with the Orgone box of Wilhelm Reich knows, or anybody that's ever made one, knows that it is a form of a capacitor, and it can hold a lot of energy until it fills up, and then it just starts to kind of pulse out of it. But it'll still hold a good charge, and it'll hold bioelectric or just straight mechanical electric energy. But it's the bioelectric energy that's particularly interesting, because the Earth, with its magnetic field, and with the Earth as an armature passing through its own magnetic field, the Earth produces a broad range, a broad spectrum of low-voltage current. Now, when we use current going into our houses, we see that our appliances operate very well and very quickly, because the type of energy we get is being made for us, perhaps at a local hydroelectric plant. We have them here in Ohio, along the Ohio River. And they set up a large cylindrical moving wheel of magnets, and they make them move as fast as possible, and then they sort of run a copper plate next to that. And the energy from the magnets basically translates through the copper into this very negatively charged current that we use. Well, the Earth produces a very positively charged current, which means that its current is made of the same kind of process of passing an armature through a magnetic field, but instead of producing a very negative charge, the magnetic field moves through many different elements, you see. And so it produces a broad spectrum of low-voltage currents, and some negative low-voltage currents, but they all tend to move toward the top of the Earth. And there, they tend to move to places where they can store themselves and become polarized. Now, highly faulted areas, like Silver Mound is, or, you know, along the west coast of the United States, or the panhandle of Florida, because it's on an island, places that have unusual combinations of the elements, will tend to accumulate more of a charge. And so the lightning strikes become more frequent, or more unusual, let's say. So in the ancient times, we believe that these people who lived 5,000 years ago understood this principle well enough to be able to create these beautiful totemic shrines in the form of various mythological creatures, giant bears, giant wildcats, serpents, and a variety of winged creatures, possums, squirrels, you name it. They created a whole pantheon of animals, and they built their lodges where the water flowed, and or on high places where the earth's spirit, the magnetic field of the earth, changed over into a current, tends to accumulate. And why did they do this? Because the atmosphere, which is much simpler in structure than the earth itself, but is fed by the same magnetic field of the earth, produces an abundance of clouds, which are all held together by a negative charge. And so when clouds get roiled up, or when they come over a very positively charged area of the earth, they tend to want to release their negative charge. And that's why we had this wonderful ionization going on at Circa Mount all the time, especially after a train, because the water vapors like to play into the ionizing effects. But what would happen if they were able to fine-tune this ionizing effect?
Well, you know, Ross, you know, yeah. I'm fascinated by you in explaining this, you know, from a bio point of view. Now, I'm familiar, and we're familiar here with Schumann's residence.
You know, I wanted to ask something. If I can interject there just a second. I don't know if this plays into this or not, but in the Serpent Mound, I don't know, are you involved with that website, Ross? Is that your site? The Serpent Mound website?
Yeah, Friends of Serpent Mound. I'm a member of the group, yeah.
Because in the Serpent Mound Mysteries, sir, it just says in his very earliest time, when both people and animals lived on Earth, a person could become an animal if he wanted to, and an animal could become a human being. Sometimes they were people and sometimes animals, and there was no difference, and all spoke the same language. I was just curious if any of this, the Serpent Mound, that the power you're talking about, the negative or positive ionization, had anything to do with this shape-shifting kind of thing.
It's believed that it did. I can explain it very briefly.
Sure.
It's kind of a divergence, but essentially, if you can get enough, accumulate enough of the Earth spirit, it can cause the atoms of your body to become very well, let's say, lubricated with the spirit of life. And although it takes some practice, when the atmosphere of the Earth is highly charged, and I'll get into explaining that a little bit later, the ability for a person's thoughts to manifest the way the individual wishes takes on a whole new meaning. So, you know, spirits who have a great command over the ethers can think that they're in a particular shape or will it, and they will take on that shape. But when the environment of the Earth isn't so rich with this interplay, this ionization, people are pretty much confined to what they're born as. And although we don't like it, there is something we can do about it. Now, the Great Pyramid at Giza is a good example of a edifice like a Manitou that would have gathered the Earth spirit, the charged energies of the Earth, perhaps boosted by a device like the Ark of the Covenant inside to give it some more oomph. But essentially, the energy would rise up to the tip of the pyramid, and there it would pass through a very well-organized piece of material like gold. And then at the very tip, you'd have your little cat's whisker or crystal. And this energy would say, I am a very positive charge. I am female. Come to me. So you have these mythologies from ancient Egypt, from ancient Greece, from the Norse myths, from the American Indian myths that all talk about the fact that the Earth Mother attracted the Sky Father. And when they're marriage was working, and they were having offspring like these Manitou or these beautiful edifices that were created throughout the Greek myths and so forth. When their relationship was working properly, there were no earthquakes because the energies were being pulled out of the earth and consummated with the sky. And this purified the atmosphere all over the planet to a degree that we cannot properly understand because it changes us spiritually, intellectually, psychically, and physically. We grow taller. We learn to live longer. We live in peace with each other because we have peace of mind. And these things are within our grasp today. After we clean up the mess we've made, we can begin to rejuvenate the Earth by, again, setting up these kinds of interactive positive and negative contacts between Earth and Heaven. Now, the subject is kind of simplistic, and we have to bear in mind that one of the keys is understanding the nature of a magnetic field. We don't understand the nature of magnetic field. We feel that the lines of force of a simple permanent magnet, like you get a Radio Shack or you have on your refrigerator, go out from the north and curl around and go into the south. Or some scientists believe that it goes out from the south, curls around, and goes into the north. But the fact is that energy is moving faster than light. It's moving faster than light, and we can contact it by putting a conductor at a 90-degree angle through it and getting some of it in terms of the nature of the conductor. So when we think about weather control, for example, we're going to have to understand that the spirits of the air, the spirits of the sky, are wild, and they foment and bring tornadoes and hurricanes and unpredictable pop-up storms and terrible windstorms and dry spells, and you name it. The weather's out of control. But the ancients knew how to get the weather under control, very simply by setting up these philosophical stations, by feeding the weather, the sky, the pure energy of the earth. They were able to bring a balance between the earth and heaven. So right now, the earth is trapping her energies inside, creating terrible hot spots and breakages in the earth's crust. These are very well advanced, too, and so we have earthquakes all the time. And we have magma flows, terrible. All these things, including a magnetic field that's unstable, could be fixed if we just began to love our mother. So we have to begin to draw the energy out of the upper parts of the earth's crust, draw it out as she produces it, give it to Father Sky, and Father Sky will return by giving all the energy of his crazy clouds to it, and this will begin to stabilize weather patterns in the areas that they're started. Now, the reason Serpent Mound is so important to us is because it's one of the last remnants, along with the Great Pyramid, one of the last remnants in the entire world that speaks to us about the fact that our forebears, 5,000 years ago, just at the beginning of the dawn of history, right, 5,000 years ago, knew how to live in harmony with nature. And they did it organically. They didn't need to dig into the earth and mine everything and create plastics to do it and terrible chemicals. They didn't need to burn off gasoline and to do the things that they needed to do. And what's beautiful about this concept is that it appears to be returning to us. It appears to be something that's coming back to us by a natural invocation of the desires of our heart to kind of get Eden back, you know, return to the Glastonbury, return to Eden, return to Tir na n'og, Valhalla, the Jade Gardens in China. Numerous paradises existed just 5 or 6,000 years ago, like little pockets all over the earth, the Elysian Fields. They were all real places, Olympus, and they existed for the benefit of humankind.
Jeffrey?
So, yeah.
Hello, Ross?
Yeah.
What would you say about the 2012 hype right now, where it's the ending of the times, the ending of the cycles? How does your belief fall into that? Do you believe that we are in for a change, or no?
But, well, I've been keeping up with the 2012 rhetoric since Jose Arguelles published his Mayan Factor back in 1985 or 1986.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been waiting for 2012. It's kind of like a lovely approach of our being aligned to very close to the center of our galaxy. And although it doesn't have any particular energy meaning, it does signify the beginning of a new count of time. It signifies the beginning of a new precessionary period, which is the amount of time it takes for the Earth to rotate, reverse once on its axis. Now, the Maya kept time according to the precept of precession, And the Greeks were aware of this same concept, and as were the Egyptians, because they were able to see that when the sun rose on the horizon at a particular point, you know, against a certain backdrop of stars, like right now, the sun rises on summer solstice in the constellation Pisces, but we're headed into the constellation of Aquarius on the horizon. So people say we're headed into Aquarius. Now, what 2012 means is that right now, at the beginning of what the Western astrologers and astronomers call Aquarius, we're beginning a new cycle that will eventually go through all the great 12 houses or 13 of the zodiac, and which are all the constellations that are visible on the horizon at the sunrise, and return back to a new cycle at this same moment when we're entering into Aquarius about 25,900.
Are you referring to the precession of the equinox?
Yes. This is called the precession of the equinox, and it's a beautiful concept because
it
also explains another cycle that our entire galaxy goes through, along with the billions and billions, I know I sound like Carl Sagan, billions and billions of uncounted other galaxies in the physical cosmos that all rotate around this central sun that the Indian sages call Vishnu Nabhi, the navel of Vishnu, the god Vishnu, the divine son of the creator. Now, what's beautiful about the precession of the equinoxes in terms of our rotating around the central sun, our galaxy, is that when we approach the closest point to the Vishnu Nabhi, when our galaxy approaches that, our magnetic field, as well as the magnetic fields of all the other stars in our galaxy, perks up dramatically and becomes really enriched with the etheric essence that gives magnetism its magnetic quality. And as we approach that, and we're approaching it now, we're about, it's about a 12,500 years going away and 12,500 years going toward the center of Vishnu Nabhi, and we're about 2,000 years going toward it from our lowest ebb, which is about 2,000 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see that 5,000 years ago we still had some smarts, but we lost them around the time of the appearance of the Messianic sage and the height of Rome, and then we fell into a very dark age because we could barely understand how to earn a living and keep our gardens clear.
But what year is your referring
to? But as we approach Vishnu Nabhi, we begin to understand the nature of electricity, which started about 1600 with William Gilbert. And then by the end of this Dwapara Yuga part, we completely are able to annihilate space through the telephone and through cars and through planes. And then we enter into another silver age, when we're able to understand the nature of the magnet. And during that period, which lasts about 3,000 years, we come to full grips on how to annihilate time along with space. So we're able to travel anywhere we wish in the twinkling of an eye. But then the golden age begins. And the Indian sages tell us that the golden age, in its ascended part, lasts for about 4,000 years. And then it goes through 4,000 years of descent. But during this period, we come to understand the nature of the cosmos and the creator. And this, they say, transcends what our mental capacity is capable of right now.
Yeah.
So what the Serpent Mound represents to us is a little timepiece or a little Manitou or a little kind of temple that was created at the end of the last period of enlightenment, degenerated completely, and now is coming back into our apprehension as being a scientific instrument that's capable of showing us the way back into an idyllic environmental change, a change that will increase what the sages call our dharma, which means basically the intellectual virtue, the ability to understand our own thoughts and understand the nature of our true selves, the part that lives past physical death, the soul. So the serpent has in its mouth this beautiful oval structure. And we believe that that structure, which some say is Atlantean in design, others say that it's an Egyptian design, but that means the swallowing up of the sulfur by the serpentine mercury to create the proverbial philosopher's stone. And what this means for us is that we will learn to balance the duality of nature, the light and the dark, the positive and the negative, the male and the female, if you will, and make ourselves divine, make ourselves capable of understanding oneness and how love is the nature of that oneness. In other words, the exudation of that unity that we're going to find. So the serpent is not just a scientific instrument, but it's sort of a spiritual temple, if you will. And by golly, if it isn't a sort of Atlantean design.
Ross?
Now, what was that?
Ross?
Yeah.
You know, just a quick note. Do you think that under the serpent mound there would be a hall of records left by the ancients for us? Like, you know, Casey talks about the Sphinx in Egypt, that under that is the Hall of Records, or a Hall of Records. But apparently there are a few chambers throughout the world that they hold this knowledge, and it was left to us by the ancients. Do you believe that there's anything left there for us besides the understanding of, you know, the physics of the mound itself?
Yeah, we feel that the serpent has a repository associated with it, because in the ancient
that
days...
That doesn't sound right, Ross.
What was that?
That doesn't sound right. It's a suppository?
No, a repository.
A repository. No, it's what...
Repository, it means like a library.
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay, now, this repository is unique. According to our best psychic informers and our best dowsers, this one was first created about 30,000 years ago, when the world was more etherealized and more of a golden age was about the earth. And in it, they stored many of the inventions and the objects of art for the period, for that time. But it also holds much of the knowledge of the history of the earth. So beneath the serpent is a vast repository, much of which is contained in the etheric dimension. In other words, it's inaccessible by us until we learn how to reactivate the serpent. Now, here's the scuttlebutt about the serpent. Adam supposedly created the serpent at the fall or the end of the garden. And he made the serpent cunningly so that it contained all knowledge. And he created it as a sort of great seal on the landscape. And anyone that learns to decipher the mystery of the serpent mound will gain the knowledge of Adam and the knowledge of the atom.
Mm-hmm.
And will be able to see into the earth and proclaim the mysteries unto heaven. You understand? So there is something going on under the serpent mound, but until we are able to completely decipher the serpent image, we will not be able to get in there. So one of the key things to understanding the mystery of the Serpent Mound is understanding not just what we are ourselves, but understanding the nature of the magnet, or in other words, the Creator. The Creator gives us an image of itself, himself or herself,
mm-hmm.
In the form of the magnet. And the magnet has a dual nature. But at the center of the magnet, the etheric light pours out in the form of a razor's edge. Now, it's when we learn to divine the magnet, or when we learn to divine our own souls, same idea, that we will be able to get below the Sphinx again, because we have to see how to regenerate the etheric essence into the atmosphere of the earth and into the atmosphere of the sky. We have to enrich the planet's topography and subterranean and the atmosphere before we can get our heads clear enough to be privileged to have this library restored for our use. Now, you think the Alexandrian... Excuse me, dear?
Yeah, I just wanted to ask you a question. Has anyone used any advanced technology to look into this Serpent Mound, or has anyone excavated under it or around it?
Well, it's pretty much guarded by state agencies. It is a precious and Native American holy site, and it's in danger of washing away. A very large portion of near the tail fell down. It's on an 80-degree cliff edge. Excuse me, 80 feet down, and it's no excavations are done there. They tried ground penetrating radar, but that's not sufficient enough. They've done some core sampling around in the area, and like I said, the whole area is highly faulted. But the area is riddled with caves, giant caves. Sometimes when the lightning strikes at Serpent Mound, you hear the thunder underground, not above ground. You hear the thunder underground as though the current made it there and flashed in a huge cavern and exploded with its thunder. Native legend suggests that there are many, many burials of their ancient people there. People that were 7 feet tall, 8 feet tall, even 9 feet tall. We found a couple of skeletons buried in the mounds near Serpent Mound, just within a stone's throw, right in the same park. These guys were, one grave was 9 feet in length, and his skull was twice the thickness of a modern human. The other guy was cut off at the knees, but he was still 6 feet long. 6 feet. Now, and
the county
is all
about...
What, excuse me?
He had three or four rows of teeth?
No. These guys had single rows of teeth, but in the counties all around Serpent Mound, hundreds of these gigantic skeletons were found. Some of them did have double rows of teeth. And these people were beautiful physically. They had no imperfections. Not only were their teeth perfect, but they had bones that showed they had no sign of acromegaly. Now, acromegaly is a disease called gigantism that Andre the Giant has, and Yao Ming of the Houston Rockets has the disease. These guys have a pituitary gland that is overactive, and so they grow to be very tall while they're young, but they don't live past the age of 37 generally. But these people live to be 100 years old, 200 years old, and some say the native people, although they're reluctant to draw the fire as skeptics, say that their ancestors lived to be 200-300 years old. And before that, they lived to be much older, and they were much taller. So,
I read it. I remember reading in your book, the Giants book, that these people were, some of these giant indigenous people were actually introduced to Jefferson and Washington during their administrations. Is that true?
Yes.
Yeah.
That is true. Jefferson wanted to meet with some of the Osage elders, and it was just one of several tribes of very, very tall men. The painter, George Catlin, who lived during Washington's administration, also went out there, and he painted some of the Osage chieftains. And they were, you know, average 7 feet in height, and they had no acromegaly. Now, this race of people is virtually extinct. The ones that lived in the Ohio Valley, they spread out to the deep south, to the Ozark Plateau, and later became the Osage. But they also moved to the east coast, and they formed a tribe called the Wolf Tribe of the Lenape Nation. And they were Adena ancestors, or excuse me, Adena offspring. And they had men that walked among them. This is New Jersey, mostly. They were in Upper New York State, or excuse me, not Upper New York State, but Lower New York, New Jersey. And they had, along the Susquehanna, they had men that were 8 feet tall. They found mass burials of them. And Captain John Smith, who was actually quite reliable, source of information, although he's been discounted because of this, stated unequivocally that he met over 60 of these men and women, and that they were so tall that they seemed like giants to the English. Well, we did the research, as you can read in the book, and we found that during Smith's time in the early 1600s, the average height of a man in Great Britain was something in the neighborhood of 5'7", and the average woman is about 5'1". But these guys were 7 feet tall, 7.5, 8 feet tall, and not only that, but he said that they were of such goodly proportion that we believe that they were the finest men we have ever seen. And also, when Jefferson sent out his first expeditions to the Ozark Plateau, they came across several tribes that had giants among them, and they said that the local people call them the fine men because they're all objects for the sculptor's art. They have the most perfect physiques, and they're most robust and healthy in their normal daily activities. Now,
so much for McDonald's.
That's right.
Yeah, I'm only joking here.
Yeah, but their people are gone now, and we think that they were descended from a far earlier race of almost supermen. The Indian legend calls them. They said they were very light skinned. Indian legend calls them supermen, and Pawnee legend says that they knew how to control the lightning in the old days. And they stood 10 feet tall. And toward the end of their reign, they went from coast to coast in the United States. And apparently they were raiding other countries, and they became a very strong military force. And about 5,000 years ago, at the end of the garden, the offspring of Adam formed this new civilization, the head of which was the state of Michigan. And it went from the Hudson Bay down to the Gulf and had seven great cities, where the cities of Sault Ste. Marie, Lansing, Cincinnati, Lexington, Atlanta, and Tallahassee all are now, were once ancient centers or chakras on this great figure that once stood in the landscape, the great Manitouba, the God King, descended from the Atlantean king.
Yeah, Ross, can I just interrupt you for just 1 second, because we're running, we got about 30 seconds. I just wanted people who are listening to be able to call in if they to want to listen further to the program. You can call 646-915-9505, in about 16 seconds here. 646-915-9505.
Or you can listen to
the archive portion in about 20 minutes or so.
Ross, I wanted to ask you, do you have a reason why this tall race died out? If they were such supermen and so unusual and had so much knowledge, why did they die out?
Well, that's the thing with the Dharma principle. We go through this cycle where we are close to Vishnu Navi and then we go far away from it. And as we go far away, farther and further away, we lose the magnetic field power and we forget. We lose our mentality. We become, stupid. We become unenlightened. And we tend to forget what our forebears knew and knew well. So you hear from Manthio and some of the ancient Greek writers that their fathers told them that men were much larger and stronger in the old days. But man has become weak, and we have been reduced to mere mortals. And it's kind of uncanny, but if you've ever fallen asleep at the wheel, you know what I'm talking about. Because we're awake and we're fine, and the next thing we're about to run into a bridge abutment because we just can't stay awake. And this is because we're out of the atmosphere that we needed to stay awake. And when we lose the spiritual technology, then we really lose. When the Manitous lost their lights, then Indians fell into darkness. The Egyptians fell into the Greeks. Everybody, all over the planet, fell into darkness about 5,000 years ago.
Yep.
Oh.
It's a strange scenario. Very, very strange. But
do you honestly believe that it's coming back now?
It's coming back. We're starting to recall. Now, I just saw a video tonight. Somebody was downtown London in the UK, and they were just filming their friends, you know, and there's a couple of guys on the street corner that were taking snapshots of the sky. So they took their camera, and they looked up, and whammo, whammo, these little bright objects were way high above the clouds, and they were just darting away. And then all of a sudden, the freaking mothership shows up. It's this beautiful ball of light, and it has kind of a rim around the edge of it, but it's luminous. And it moves out, and it's like peeking out from behind the cloud, and then it like goes boing, and it zips away behind the cloud again so you can't see it, as though it were teasing the people down to look at it. Now, what are UFOs? Well, they're us, but they're people that live in a part of the earth that never went into the degenerate stage. and we're coming close to rejoining them.
I like the way you put that.
Where are those? Are they in the inner earth or where?
Well, you might say that they're part of the inner earth, but they're also part of the external earth. If you mean by inner, the spiritual earth, the part that's of a higher frequency, yeah. But what they have and what we don't have is the ability to generate the ether by bringing together the positive and the negative charges, you see? And by bringing together the positive and the negative charges on the right substance, they can produce an abundance of ether. And that's what makes their vehicles move so quickly. They've mastered time and space, and just like we had once. But they're waiting for us to come back. They're teasing us. They're making it an intriguing adventure for us. And we're at our wit's end trying to figure out who the hell they are and what they're doing. But where they are, they have intergalactic trade.
If that's the case, why, and they're actually external beings here, or inner Earth beings, why have they allowed us to screw up the planet so badly?
Well, we have and we haven't. The Earth that we know is like the outer crust of the actual Earth. It's like a sand box that we've been given to play in. The damage that we've done to the Earth, which is a very real thing to us, the damage we've done is correctable. And it will be corrected, if by no other way, by Mother Nature. But the fact is that we'll not only learn how to reverse the damage we've done, but we'll be able to restore the things that we've disarticulated, and we'll be able to make up for what we've done. The reason...
You know, Ross, I believe in what you're saying is right. And, you know, you take a look at what happened over there in Japan with the nuclear power plants that went up. I mean, you know, there is an alternative. I do feel that. And we may not have it in our hands right now, but we will come up with it. I have no doubt. Because we've done it before.
Yeah, the ancient Indian subcontinent told us that they knew how to purify radioactive materials. They had a science called Kimiagiri, which was able to take a radioactive substance and take away its harmful radiation.
Yeah.
Simply by coating the individual atoms with a subatomic matrix. Like it actually used sulfur that was broken down into kind of subatomic particles. And when this sulfur is matured properly, they're able to coat the radioactive material and make it harmless. You could take it like a pill and it wouldn't even hurt you. But these are things that are so simple that we're missing how to do them, because the keys have been taken away. And those keys are intimately related to our being able to remain focused for more than 5 seconds at a time. Learn to meditate. If anybody asks me advice, learn to meditate for more than 20 minutes. Learn how to focus on a single thing without letting your mind come in. And this is how we clear away the karmas that keep us from understanding who we are and what our potential is. Thank you. And another really interesting thing about all this is that it really is quite a privilege for us to be on the Earth in our lowest sphere at this time, because we're here to put up with and overcome, to rise above handicaps that have been given to us by nature through this natural cycle. Now, most spirits, most souls, and there's an uncountable number of them, and by the way, most people are humanoid in form, because the universe is in the shape of a man, but that's another story. Most people come to this plane because the gravity is so heavy and because it takes a lot to overcome the hardship here, and therefore it builds strength and character in the spirit. So there's tons of people clamoring to incarnate on the Earth, and that's why we have an overpopulation problem. And the reason they're clamoring to come is because they want to have the toughest time they can. And also because the highest and most evolved spiritual masters come to the lowest places in order to find the people who want to get the most, the best. Or I should say the best, the most. So there's this sort of dichotomy between what we think is the purpose of life and what the actual purpose of life is, and that is to overcome. Now, like I was saying, most souls who live on all the heavenly planets are leading lives that are far easier, and they live long, and they grow tall, and they're happy. As a matter of fact, the universe progresses from miserable, where we are, to the happy hunting ground, up to a level of joy, up to a level of bliss, up to a level of ecstatic bliss, and on into spheres of consciousness that we can't even understand. But if you're privileged enough to come here to the Earth, where life is difficult to maintain, I mean, look at all the other planets. They can't sustain life. They might have life in some form, but not anything like we have. And isn't it odd that our atmosphere is perfectly balanced and that water maintains its liquid state without boiling or freezing in most of the planet? And isn't it odd that the moon has this strange cycle where it doesn't ever but face the Earth, so the moon actually rotates once on its own axis every time it goes around us to keep hidden from us? What's that about? You know, and what are these dynamics going on? Why is the Earth so special and unique? Well, because not that many people come to the gross physical to incarnate. But in the etheric world, you know, where the UFOs are, there's people on every planet and every moon. There's just jillions of people. And the race of man is vast. And no two races are alike among that race, no two sub-races. We're the human race. And even on the Earth, we have five or six different skin colors and types. But on Venus, for example, my understanding is that the people have very large eyes. And they use those eyes to eat the sunlight because they don't really eat much food. They're the people that have the small mouths and the big eyes to graze.
Do they have to?
They're our friends. You know, they're friends with us. They're just another type of man. And
how do they exist on that planet? I mean, it's uninhabitable as far as we know.
Yeah, that's the physical part of it. We live in the physical part of Earth. If you catch what I was just saying, I don't think I was very clear.
Right.
But our physical Earth, not our ethereal Earth, not our astral Earth, our physical Earth is uniquely qualified to hold human life.
Right.
It was specially made to have the privilege of incarnating where the gravity is extremely harsh so we can overcome it. So it's a privilege to come to the Earth. Now, the Venusians and the Martians could revamp their lower Earth atmosphere to sustain man and woman for their own people. They could do it, but they choose not to, because most of the spheres of their planet are located above the gross physical. Most of Venus is in six planes that are above it, and most of Mars are on planes above it, and Uranus and Saturn and Jupiter, they all have counterparts in the astral world and the causal world, but they've chosen not to keep their lower physical active because it just isn't worth it. It's just expensive. And besides, if you want to incarnate on the physical, go to the Earth if you live in this solar system.
So, Josh, I'm going to ask you if you would kindly come back on and be our guest, in another week or so. Would you be available maybe next Thursday or next Friday?
I guess we could shoot for next Friday again.
Right.
But I need a heads up. I'm forgetful.
What's that?
Give me a call ahead of time so I remember.
Yeah, I was thinking, or even the following week, if that's better for your schedule. But I'd love to be able to have you back on because this show runs live for about an hour and then it records for the archives. And so all that we've talked about for the last 20 minutes is still recording. But
to be able to hear it live,
the depth of your of your knowledge and the areas we've just skimmed the surface of what I think is where we should go with this. We'd love to have you back. How about you, George? Are you available?
Oh, sure, yes.
So maybe you and Ross could talk about when would be good in...
Next Thursday. I know usually Friday we're off next Friday, but...
The following Friday.
Possibly Thursday night would be great if you're available, or the following Thursday or Friday night.
Okay, sure. We could do something. Just have George give me a heads up.
I'll give you a heads up on that. We'll talk, you know, off the show, and we can make arrangements on that. But Ross, I have to thank you for, you know, spending your time with us. And there's so many areas that we've spent years on, you know, talking and explaining and looking at it from different points of view. And, you know, the progression of the equinox is just one of those aspects. And, of course, we've hit upon a lot of studies, like Zechariah Sitchin's work with the Earth Chronicles and talking about the 12th planet and in the barrel and so forth. But, you know, it's all a part of the legends and the experiences from the ancients.
I'd like to concentrate on, further on what we're talking about tonight, but even more so as far as the balance of the Earth, trying to understand how the Earth is rebalancing and how we are possibly being able to find our way again with this. I think of it as ascension consciousness, but under the Mayan calendar in 2012 and so on, all of this stuff seems to be coming together, at least historically. So
we'll talk about that.
Well, we'd love to talk more to you about this and more about the serpent mounts, the negative and positive energies, and possibly find a solution to, or at least not, I don't know if it's a solution, but
to understand
the prophecy, you know, a little better through you and through your work.
Sure.
It was a fascinating discussion tonight. I was really, really, really thankful we had you on. And, George, thanks for introducing us, as always. But this is the kind of topic that George and I and Lila have been talking about for the last, 4 years now? On the radio here. So,
we want to thank folks for listening.
Yeah, and we want to thank everybody who's listening tonight and tell your friends about it. And hopefully we can have you back on next week, and I'll get in touch with you, and I'm sure George will.
Ross,
would you
like to give us your email address?
Oh, sure.
One more time.
You ready?
Yes.
Yep.
D as in dog. D. Dot Ross, R-O-S-S, dot Hamilton, H-A-M-I-L-T-O-N, at gmail.com.
Okay.
All right.
So D. Dot Ross. Dot Hamilton at gmail.com.
Sounds great.
Sounds good. All right.
Thank
you,
guys.
All right, then, ladies. Thank you.
God be with you, Ross. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Ross.
Thank you, George, for hooking up with Ross and bringing him to us, and we look forward to more talks with him.
We will talk. Look, folks, God bless you, and have a nice weekend, and I'll see you in the funny papers.
Okay.
I'm only kidding. Not you, Lila. Lila, I will. Or Leo, I will.
Leo, you will. Thank you, George.
All right. And I want to thank everybody who joined us tonight, and wish you the best. And we will be, hopefully we'll have Ross on again. We will have George on again very soon, but hopefully we'll have Ross on as well, possibly next Thursday night. So keep informed, take a look at the upcoming shows, and that'll be announced. So I want to thank everybody again for joining us, and we wish you peace.